And our next speaker is Fred Borland from the University of Arkansas, and he'll be presenting on breeding for resistance to bacterial blight in cotton.
Okay, very good. Okay, I've got plenty of time. I told Terry she could have some of my time, and I'm really a little bit angry that I didn't get to go first, because Terry's already told you everything. So, but maybe I'll take it from a different direction, or at least confirm what she told you. And after I say it, maybe you'll believe her, right? Okay. What I'd like to do today, I'll review some of the breeding work, some of the genetics work that's been done on bacterial blight. And as Terry mentioned, the genetics of bacterial blight is probably as well understood as any disease, perhaps, and even other crops. Then I'll go through some of the TAMMAR programs. This is the Luther Bird program. I have a long association with that because I did my graduate work with Dr. Bird back in 1970, in the 70s. I started there in 73, so that's how long I've been working with bacterial blight. And then over the years, I've developed some modifications in the approach that he's taken. Thank you. As many people, I'm suffering from some cold, so excuse my voice today. Thirdly, I'll talk about some bacterial blight resistance in today's cotton lines. This will be quite a bit of repeat of what, or some repeat, but from a little different direction that Terry mentioned, but specifically more from my program. And then talk about some persistent concerns that I have. In 2011, I had one of our consultants that's close to us, that's a very, very established consultant, brought some plants into my office, and immediately, as soon as I saw them, I knew there was bacterial blight. Fortunately, I had some of these young ladies that worked for me during the summer. They were in the office, so I, in order to shame the consultant, I turned to the ladies, young girls, and said, "What is this?" In unison, they said, "It's bacterial blight." Now, that I tell you that story for two reasons. One is to indicate how obscure bacterial blight had become. This consultant, I won't mention his name, I don't see him here, but it wouldn't make any difference. But he had a very well-respected consultant that had worked for 20 years, and I'm sure he had never seen it before. And then secondly, you see from this story, is that it's very easy to recognize. These young girls, I would have fired them if they hadn't have, and then they, since they'd been looking in my plots. But as Terry mentioned, here's some of the symptoms. Angular leaf spot, a very obvious type of symptom that occurs. On that lower right, you see when it gets in vein, it can actually curl up that leaf. It can really cause some severe damage, cause defoliation. The defoliation generally doesn't cause any yield loss. It can get severe enough to cause yield loss. It can cause this black arm disease. In literature, it talks about that if you get a severe black arm, you can get lodging of the plant from that bacterial infection on the stem. I don't know that I've ever seen lodging. Have you, Terry, from black arm? I've seen a little bit of black arm, but I've never seen it severe enough to really cause lodging. Probably the part that we're most concerned about in our area is this boll rot. If it comes in late in the season, you can get severe enough on boll rot to cause a significant amount of damage to the bolls and significant damage to yield. Here's some of the literature going back. Knight and Colson in 1939 worked out much of the inheritance. And what this is a series of B genes. And these genes, it's very interesting, and I think Terry had a slide of it and took it out, of the sort where these origin of these B genes. They're very diverse. They come from different species, different areas of the world. The people that put these resistance together should be greatly applauded. It's amazing what they brought these major genes together. It's kind of interesting, if you go back to that 1939 paper, the title of it is not the inheritance of this B genes or bacterial blight. It's the inheritance of black arm disease in cotton, which tells me that black arm symptom was a much more concern at that point than the angular leaf spot. Luther Bird and Lester Blank in 1951 published an article on the methods, which was on the methods of screening. There's a bulletin there. Then Brinkerhoff at Oklahoma State had a technical bulletin in 1970, and then also an article in the Annual Review of Phytopathology in 1970. I really recommend, if you're really interested in bacterial blight, go to those three articles, particularly those two bulletins. The one of Brinkerhoff's is 95 pages. It's every detail you ever thought about wanting to know about bacterial blight. It is a very extensive review of his work and what all was done. The article of 1968 is the one Terry mentioned, where they used host differentials to identify different races of the bacterial of the Xanthomonas bacteria. Then Ings, Brown, and Walker, 1974. This work was in Uganda, working on the resistance to bacterial blight, as published in Heredity. Then Hussein and Brinkerhoff, 1978. Is where they it's identified to race 18. It came from Pakistan, is where as I understand where it first came from. Then the article by Bird in 1982, then the Brinkerhoff and all in 1984. These are the both of these is where in both researchers took major genes and minor gene complexes and built it together, really put together resistance, to the point that they use the word immunity. Now, I had a minor in plant pathology. I still have it, I guess. I guess once you get it, you have it, you've got it. Kind of like an infection. The word immunity for pathologists is rarely used. And to me, this really tells you the level of resistance that they were able to get this published in Plant Disease and called it immunity. And this is exactly what Terry was talking about, that this the level of resistance that we have today. Robert Wright in 1998 published some DNA mapping of the resistant genes. Then Thax in 2001, again, the article that Terry mentioned with the race identification indicated that mostly what we're dealing with is race 18, or essentially now is race 18. So let's look at how cotton breeding programs have used this well-established resistance, and as I indicated, probably from an aspect of the genetics of it, is as well known as any kind of disease, which ones have used it. Bird, Elzik, followed by Elzik and Thaxton and Texas A&M, the MAR program. At that time, there were some Texas seed companies were using it. Stoneville Pedigree Seeds screened for bacterial blight in the 70s and 80s. Then when Peggy moved to Mississippi State, she continued that work. As far as I know, indicate that this is my list. This is not necessarily exhaustive. It's just exhaustive of my mind. What currently is going on, I continue to screen for bacterial blight. I was at Mississippi State 10 years and been at the University of Arkansas since then. The CSIRO program in Australia has a very extensive program screening for bacterial blight, and the FiberMax material that she mentioned is resistant. That's where the base of that came from. This company in Brazil, Mato Grosso, Brazil, is extensively screening for bacterial blight. And I know Phytogen and probably Monsanto, I'm not sure the other companies, they're now using molecular markers. I know that Mustafa McPherson uses that, then, but how he uses it is to identify lines to select, but then he says that they still have to be scratched or inoculated to prove that they are, to verify that they are resistant. So, why has bacterial blight resistance been such a low priority breeding program in the U.S.? One is simply the wide use of acid-linted seed. It's greatly, when the acid-linting of seed came in the 50s and 60s, that greatly reduced the spread and occurrence of bacterial blight. Secondly, is even when you get bacterial blight, generally it's a very relatively low yield loss associated with bacterial blight. It's associated with the timing of the bacterial blight comes in, and then if it comes in late enough, you'll get boll rots as a severe problem. A third one is kind of a negative, double negative. Center pivot irrigation did not exacerbate the problem. I really thought back in the 1980s when center pivot became widespread in the Delta region, I thought, here I am in the right place. I've got bacterial blight resistance. Everybody's going to come to me. Curiously, though, and the idea was that, you know, once you get bacterial blight in the field, if you're center pivoting, it will just simply carry that bacteria all around the field, and you've got an epidemic or epiphytotic. Is that what the pathologists say? But that has not been the case. Sprinkling irrigation can exasperate the problem, but center pivots has not necessarily been the vehicle to carry it across the field that I would have expected. And then, finally, for many years, bacterial blight resistance just simply was not considered worth the extra work required to inoculate and screen materials. It's not hard, but it is another step that you have to take in terms of screening materials. Now, let's go back to the MAR program that Luther Bird had, and then Camille Elzik and Peggy Thaxton. It combined screening for bacterial blight with other diseases. And it started off with screening for resistance to for cold tolerance. And what we would do is plate acid-linen seed on a water auger in a non-sterile environment and put these plates in 13.3 centigrade incubators, then select for ones that would resist mold growth. Mold growth is an indicator that exudates are coming through the seed coat and would form a substrate for the mold growth. So we select for absence of mold growth and slow germination at that low temperature. These seeds are then planted into cups, and a modification that I did is put the seed on the side of the cup with the micropowder in, pointing to the edge, and you'll see the reason for that in a moment. Oops, not that fast. Once we got them in the greenhouse, we would scratch inoculate them either with a pen like this, a modified drawing pen, or you can use toothpicks or anything else. Just simply dip it into the inoculum and scratch inoculate it. And as Terry said, in about 10, 14 days, you get water soaking. It's either a very nice resistant or susceptible reaction. Now, the ones that were resistant, then what I would do is cut them along the side of the cup, and that reveals, since I planted on the side of the cup, the micropowder end to the side of the cup, it reveals the seedling roots. So we added some additional selection for enhanced seedling root development. And so this was a nice little technique that I used for several years. In the field, we use a modified Mudmaster sprayer. In our area, we get muddy days, so this helps us be able to go ahead and inoculate when we want to. I've always inoculated spraying from underneath, and that comes from Luther Bird, that the stomates were on the bottom of the leaf, so we spray up. Terry obviously has very good fortune going down. Now, the real key in inoculating, as she mentioned, is this surfactant. I think you called it magic. It's just about magic. If you go back to Bird and Blank's method paper, they used a pressure of 100 to 150 psi. Brinkerhoff used 400 psi. That just almost blow the leaves off. That just amazes me. But this is what you had to do to ensure that you got good inoculation without this surfactant. With this surfactant, as you know, Terry just sprays it over the top. I still, just out of habit, I still spray, and I've got the rig to spray from underneath. I don't think it makes any difference. So this surfactant has really been a great catalyst for being able to get much better. If you've got good bacteria with bacteria and with the surfactant, you can just about bet you'll get good inoculation. So currently, the way I use it in my program, we use a field spray inoculation after stand. We'll thin in our segregating populations, we thin plants down to individual plants so that we can rogue them. We use an inoculum, always include race 18. Before race 18, we would use a combination of different races that would give you kind of the same level of coverage of the different genes. Then we inoculate 2 to 4 leaves using this Mud Master spray with the surfactant. We use this, we select resistant plants then in our segregating populations. And one of the important points in my program is in any, we'll also inoculate progeny rows. And if we find a progeny row that's segregating, we discard that progeny row. And the point of this is that I make selections in the F4, so if there's still some residual heterozygosity, sometimes I can pick that up with bacterial blight, those few showing up. So that allows me to clean that up. We also will use it to field spraying our seed increases to catch the occasional susceptible plant that might show up in resistant lines. In the greenhouse, we use a scratch inoculation. We plant seed in flats, thin them to about 12 plants per plot, 2 to 3 reps. We collect infected leaves, grind them, just dry them and grind them. Simply store them in our cold room or cool room where we store our seed. Then we add, and the nice thing about this, for a non-pathologist, I can always have inoculum ready. So we simply take a 1/4 of a teaspoon of powder to 50 milliliters of distilled water. Now, I understand, I recognize this is mixing English and metric systems. But that's what my technicians do, and it works. So that's what we do. And you bake it for 3 hours. So that about sounds like that kind of recipe. Anyway, we inoculate, we scratch inoculate using either that drafting pin or a toothpick, and then 1 to 2 weeks, depending on temperature. If it gets cool, it'll take a lot longer for those symptoms to show up. And here we are evaluating a percent of resistance, resistant plants in a variety of strains. And again, we can evaluate our progenies to see if they're segregating. And here's just a picture of the scratch inoculation using in the greenhouse. And as you can see, you crowd these up and get a lot of plots in a small area in the greenhouse. So it's a very simple thing to do and a nice rainy day project. So here's simply just the logistics of how I use it in my program. We make our crosses. In the segregating populations, F2, F3, and F4, we will use field inoculation and rogue out susceptible plants so that we hopefully have gotten to resistance then. And the first year of progeny rows, we will, again, as I indicated before, we will field inoculation, discard them if they're segregating. At the advanced level, we'll take them in the greenhouse and scratch inoculation because we get a much better indication of exactly if there's any showing up. On field inoculation, you might miss that occasional susceptible plant. We do the same thing with our strains test where we have replicated strains test. Our seed increases, we use a field inoculation, and then in regional tests such as RBTN, regional high quality, and our state variety test, we use a scratch inoculation. And I really just started doing state variety. I haven't done it as long as Terry because I wasn't concerned with it, but since 2011, since the outbreak, I've started doing that for our materials. So then after 10 years, we release the germplasm line, or a variety, or most of them we discard. And that's how breeding goes. So the releases that we've made, the bacterial blight resistance in today's line, in the U of A system, in our program since 1986, I've released 86 germplasm lines and 6 cultivars. This includes some of them that I released when I was at Mississippi State. 76 of the 88 germplasm lines and all 6 of the 6 cultivars are resistant to bacterial blight. So we do have resistance available. The question then comes is why have I bred for bacterial blight resistance? First of all, for me, it's an easily established. If you have good cultures, it's easy to establish. And if you have resistant genes, it's very easy to screen for it and establish it. Secondly, it establishes distinctive characteristic for releases. When you start releasing a line, it's a black and white. Either it's resistant or it's not to bacterial blight. So it makes a very good indicator for characteristic for your line. Thirdly, it provides insurance against epiphytotic. I was somewhat happy in 2011 when bacterial blight broke out because I knew all my materials were resistant. So don't tell anybody that. Fourthly, it aids in maintaining pure lines by identifying these segregating populations and also identifying off-types in your seed increases. Fifthly, it may, both Brinkerhoff and Bird suggested that host plant resistance, once you get the immunity to bacterial blight, it may provide some horizontal resistance to other diseases and to insects. And that's not well established, but there are at least some degrees of that. And finally, probably just because it's a 44-year-old habit, I've been doing it, and I don't know any other way to breed cotton. Here's the bacterial blight resistance in the variety test. This is from the Arkansas variety test. And you see in 2013, 8 of the 36 varieties were resistant. This past year, 34 of the 50, I should have added those together, 57 varieties were resistant. We've had a tremendous increase in the amount of resistant lines. And you can see in 2013, that resistance was somewhat randomly, all of my lines that were in the variety test were resistant, and it was somewhat randomly among the others. There was no real one company had all resistant lines. In 2014, this International Seed Technology Group started submitting lines. They're a group from Brazil, and most of their lines are resistant to bacterial blight. And then in this past year, you can see that Phytogen made a big jump in their resistance. And part of this is where Mustafa has started at a molecular level screening for or developing bacterial blight resistance and confirming it with inoculation. So, and also Monsanto. So there is good news there, that there are good sources of resistance and they are being used. A final thing I want to mention is some persistent concerns. This is a picture I took from Hussein and Brinkerhoff's article in 1978. It shows the host differentials. And you can see they identified race 18, only one line. All other lines in this host differential are susceptible to race 18, except this 101 and 102B. And I really don't know exactly what that line is. I think it's a line that came from Luther Bird's program. And that's the real concern. Well, and you can see how these things break out. And it's a really nice picture of how these things, how you identify races and how you can separate them out simply by how different lines respond to these different races. Now, my concern is, one, is the availability and purity of all of these host differentials. I know Peggy Thaxton was maintaining these, and that she indicated to me before she retired that she was concerned about the purity of some of these host differentials. She thought they had perhaps changed. You know, lines change in our programs. They don't necessarily say pure. So, you know, I think I don't know if these even exist. Terry, do you know if they do? Okay. I would like to see some effort made to get these put into the germplasm collection so that they're not just floating out here somewhere. They really need to be verified what they are, then put into a... Well, that's another problem, isn't it? That's my second problem, the purity and virulence of races. So the races don't exist? Except race 18? Well, that's another question. See, I had a question mark beside that. The third question is, and Peggy, I think, Terry addressed this, over time, are new races evolving? And apparently not. When I was put this together, you were very concerned that there was, and before you determined there was a Pseudomonas. Then what races are actually naturally occurring? Well, Peggy Thaxton pretty much indicated and verified that we're dealing with race 18. So as long as it stays there, we're good. Our resistance is good. A second concern, and this on my own personal basis, the access to virulent cultures. I have through Dr. Bird's program, Elzik and Thaxton, they maintain these cultures and the different races very well over time. But apparently, many of those races have been lost. There's restrictions to moving cultures over state line. I've determined that APHIS is not my friend. In fact, also they don't trust me. So there's some problems there. I've tried to use this method that they use down in Brazil, which is based on field collected infected leaves. And basically this is what they do. And I won't go through all of this, but they collect leaves infected with bacterial blight. They dry them down, grind them to a powder, use that to make a bacterial suspension, 4 grams per liter of water, filter the solution and inoculate with it. Well, the problems with it is, one is it's hard to find that much bacterial blight around, particularly with 4 grams of infected leaves per liter of water. That's 3.67 pounds of powder for me to put in my 110-gallon tank. That's a lot of leaves, and I don't have access to that. But then, even after we did that, when we filtered the back, I must not done it right, because we could not keep from stopping up sprayer. It was whatever we did, it took a long time, but we still didn't manage to filter it well. So the final persistent concern I have is simply just to be able to effectively, efficiently and confidently screen for resistance. If I can get race 18, if I can do that. Otherwise, you know, I'm kind of particularly I can do the scratch inoculations with infected leaves that I find, but the real problem is getting enough. I need cultures to be able to do my field inoculation and be able to screen those early generations. Otherwise, I'm kind of working in the dark at that point. So, conclusion there. I think there has been a resurgence of bacterial blight related to part of it is relaxed screening for resistance and scouting in seed production fields. And this is really kind of hit home in 2011. Many of our consultants didn't know what bacterial blight looked like. And I suspect many of the seed certification fields were looked at, may have had bacterial blight, but no one recognized what it was, because we were getting seed coming in with xanthomonas in it. Secondly, is this field greenhouse molecular marker methods can be used to identify resistant plants and lines, and that the molecular marker methods apparently work very well with this. This pretty much narrows down. If you're wanting bacterial blight resistance, you can pretty much establish there, then just simply confirm it with field inoculation. There's known resistance that can be incorporated in lines, and at least from my perspective, there's no noticeable deleterious effects of having the bacterial blight resistant genes in the lines. So it's not carrying a genetic load. So this is, again, it's just nice insurance to put it in there. I think we've seen the number of bacterial blight resistant varieties have increased in recent years. It'll likely, but bacterial blight, I predict, will again become a non-issue until we quit screening for it. And then it will come back and rear its ugly head again. Thank you.
Okay, I would like our two bacterial blight speakers to come up here so they can answer questions. We can have our discussion session. And Bob, you're welcome too.
Fred alluded to the issues of getting cultures, and when blight was controlled through resistance, it was because Luther Bird and later Peggy Thaxton and Elzik, they were growing up gobs of the stuff, and they were giving it out to anybody, anywhere who wanted it. And you see it cited over and over and over again. The companies could screen for it because Luther Bird and his associates grew the bacteria up and gave it away to anybody who wanted to use it. And you can't do that with APHIS. APHIS is not going to give you permission to get an isolate from somewhere else and spray it in the field. That's just not going to happen. And so part of the problem is being able to get all the entities to do the screening when they can't get isolates from other people.
I'm not entirely familiar with all the regulations of APHIS, but since it's our wonderful government working for us and it's obviously an endemic disease, that the map I showed is we're isolating it already from virtually every state in the Cotton Belt, I would say this is stupid. Well, can't we address stupid?
Well, so I showed starting in 2005, the triple nickel was resistant to blight and grown on something like 85% of the acres in Georgia and presumably the southeast. So it historically depends on what your varieties were that you grew. And there were some excellent, excellent varieties that kept the blight from developing. It was when we lost the triple nickel, we lost 444, we lost popular varieties that the growers loved. They weren't picking them because they were blight resistant. They were picking them because they loved the varieties, and they happened to be blight resistant. And the companies could develop blight resistant varieties because of Luther Bird and subsequent people who assisted them. Because most companies do not employ plant pathologists to manage diseases like blight. They were dependent on Luther Bird's program to help them do the screening. And so when we lost that resource and they developed their varieties without screening, and it just happened to be that, you know, the varieties the growers liked didn't have blight. It took a few years for a problem to develop, but it did.
I'd like to say something nice about seed companies. It doesn't make sense to put money into your program to add genes or screen or anything, you know, just invest in your program for a disease that's of no consequence. And the unfortunate, you know, Fred, I was in Kaiser when we had that meeting about the outbreak. Remember that in 2011? People didn't know what it looked like. And it was, I was literally stood there with my mouth open when Fred showed a slide that showed how many very popular varieties were susceptible. I went, whoa, why is this? And the answer is, in people running programs to provide varieties, they dropped diseases that seemed to be of no consequence. Unfortunately, there's a biological penalty. Bacterial blight didn't drop out. And so when we had, and I showed the slide here that's compounded or compiled by Annie Phillips, who's working with us at Danforth, when we stopped growing resistant varieties, surprise, we found out that the bacterium was still there. So I think that's largely the story. You want to manage? Sure. Guy Key is trying to ask you something. Yeah. How about 9/11? Here's a charm right there. That was a problem. No, excuse me, 9/12.
I don't know if 9/12 was ever thought to be blight.
No, it wasn't. It was a very popular variety in Mid-South, eaten up.
When 1044 it came out and was listed as blight resistant. the genes weren't functional, even if they were there.
Maybe the marker was in the wrong place.
I tested it 1044 before it came out. It always tested susceptible to Grace 18 in my program. When the literature came out in 2010 and said 1044 was resistant, I had a, oh my goodness, because I had tested it prior to that and it was clearly susceptible to Grace 18. And I knew it had, the markers had said it was resistant, but never tested resistant. Race 18 is the one in Australia, and it's predominant in many countries, but Brazil does have other races that are higher in number. Africa has other races. I'm not sure about India. I think race 18 is predominant, but they use a different numbering system, so I'm not entirely sure on the India.
We're up to 22.
But mostly race 18 is still the prevalent one in most countries. The incidence is lower, consistently a little bit lower, but I don't know whether you have, I don't know, since I don't know how these varieties are composed. I'm really more interested even in the partial susceptible and partial resistant, where it does change dramatically. I don't know if things are being blended or what. Right, you will have fewer plants that are showing symptoms. It's an incidence count that I use. You will see in really susceptible plants, lesion size can vary too, but I don't rate lesion size. I find that that's usually correlated with incidence. And I can't tell you whether that's a blend of different lines in that variety or not.
In my screening, the intermediate, that would be heterogeneous, but it might be also poor enough that I...
Well, it's a repeated response in those results. Those varieties that are not fully susceptible, it's a very repeatable response from year to year to year. They are not as susceptible.
One of the things that I get to do is burn a whole lot of jet fuel and look at cotton in different fields all across the country. And quite frankly, I think that the bacterial blight looks different in different places. And I don't have enough good notes or pictures to put it all together and figure it out if this is varietal or if, in fact, we have something else. Because, for instance, the haloing that we talked about, Terry says she doesn't see it. In fact, when I've gone out and walked with Jason, I haven't seen it. I have misidentified bacterial blight in Florida for target spot. Took me about a half hour to figure out what I was really looking at.
Well, that's why I wonder if there are those places that get more fungal infection on the leaves.
Yep.
Whether that's a kind of a composite bacterial blight fungal.
Yeah. We about 2 years ago, we did a general bulletin on identification of foliar diseases, and Terry asked me about this before. We've just exactly done one for bacterial blight. It was my intention to bring it here, but we actually got it late, and there's miscommunication. I left without it. So we are, as of today, shipping out on request something like over 3,000 copies to pathologists, extension pathologists throughout the country, and we'll give it to anybody. I mean, that's the intention of it. So we have a bacterial blight bulletin that goes through the symptomology, and it goes through, it presents Terry's screen and identifies susceptible and resistant varieties according to that screen. So we're naming names on what's susceptible with the intention of trying to suppress what we have as a kind of an outbreak in Georgia and Alabama right now.
Thank you.
Populations you're working with, you know, until we have a truly comprehensive understanding of these diseases and we can associate them all with markers or even better genes, we won't know what's going on with the horizontal resistance phenomena. For certain diseases, I believe that the genetics of resistance are related. That is, if you have resistance to one thing, it helps you with others, because at the cellular level, you're dealing with a relative... I mean, the plant just stands there, and it has one basic immunological system and probably a few responses. So I think some of the genes, this is getting very speculative, are probably immunological in nature. They're in the exterior of the system, not the interior cellular response. So I think at some level, we have genes that are key. We have key genes that function in resistance horizontally. But a lot of the differences are in how the plant, how the initial infection occurs.
You know, the Fibromax variety has mostly been resistant, and yet in other parts of the U.S., they have all sorts of leaf spot problems and defoliation problems, is my understanding. And so that would suggest that they're not being protected against other fungal diseases. At least with that Fibromax package.
Any more questions? We have a few minutes. Do you want to make any closing remarks, Bob? Okay. We will transition then to our FOV4 section.